plan of action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to be hitting you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the US Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the President to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said a citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leadership in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers.
Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community, then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Another necessary task is to develop characters. Of course, some personalities are already famous. Personalities in the army, in the guards corps, in the police force, and also a number of Basij soldiers who are not in the armed forces, but there are many personalities who are not well known. Many biographies are written by individuals who have no fame, and they are many, but they have achieved great feats. Important issues and events are ascribed to them. There should be commemoration ceremonies for personalities where individuals discuss their role. They should do research on them, and they should discuss the details of their life. The discussion about the defenders of the holy shrines, which I touched on, is really one of the most interesting subject matters in our era, as it is a very important event. Syrian, Lebanese, Iraqi, Iranian, and Afghani soldiers stood alongside one another in one single line and for one single goal. This is an astonishing event. It is one of the greatest phenomena of our time, which is another blessing of the Sacred Defense Era.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Well, my discussion is over. I only wish to add something about the issue of the coronavirus. You should not underestimate the coronavirus. When 150 compatriots are lost every day, is this a minor issue? Some people do not have a correct estimate and evaluation about this issue. Imagine that an airplane with 300 passengers crashes every 2 days and all of them die. Is this a minor incident? If we have 140, 150, 170 victims every day, is this a minor tragedy? The cure is in our own hands. Well, as you see, the officials in charge are really sacrificing themselves. Physicians, nurses, managers, and others are all working hard. Therefore, we should carry out our duties.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The debate.
The judge in the U.S. has ordered the U.S.'s intelligence agencies to acknowledge that they possess a tape recording of the 2018 assassination of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The judge also instructed the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, an office of the Director of the National Intelligence, to explain why they are withholding the tape and a CIA report on the gruesome killing. In this debate, we will ask why these agencies are withholding the tape and why it would take this long for this judge to make this move. Also look at the timing of this announcement. Do stay with us for this debate. Let's bring in our guest to discuss this. Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, joins us from Washington, D.C. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, date of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, October 2nd of 2018. Today's date, December 9, more than 2 years after the date of the assassination. Why do you think it would take this long for this announcement to be made and for this move to be made, which would prompt them to make, obviously, an announcement that should have been made when the assassination took place and when they got that information?
Well, I think straight away the American intelligence, first of all, knew perfectly well what was going on. They would have been perfectly aware that Jamal Khashoggi was on the target list, and indeed they would have been aware of his movements, and they obviously subsequently have engaged in a cover-up of absolutely outrageous proportions. Right from the outset of when the news was released, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hand-delivered a plan to the Saudi royal families, helped the Crown Prince get away literally with murder. You know, he was engaged from a very early stage in damage limitation. You know, Middle East Eye and various other well-known, if you like, established journals, etc., and broadsheets across the American corporate media network themselves have been pointing fingers, and it's been an open discussion, really, that Pompeo devised this plot to help shield Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from the fallout following the highly publicized murder. Pompeo discussed the plan with Saudi Arabia's king during a visit to the country's capital soon after, a couple of weeks after, I think, it happened. And they methodically went through this process of plausible deniability, and they worked out this thing. They were actually quite blatant about it. And it's rooted in one fundamental thing. The US is tied to Saudi Arabia at the hip. The dollar, the US dollar, has floated on the back of Saudi oil control of prices, etc. It's also floated the U.S. Arms industry, because Saudi Arabia has bought $13 billion worth of arms for its war on Yemen, which again is totally backed and instigated, supported by their American allies. And these two factors, the arms industry, the oil resources that the Americans desperately need to fill their debt holes in their own economy, necessitated that Donald Trump would do and say whatever was necessary to cover up the incompetence of the out-murder of Khashoggi by the Saudi establishment.
Okay. Michael Springman, we're looking at what the judge has instructed the two of the most important agencies in the U.S. to do, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, to explain why they're withholding the tape and a CIA report also. I mean, aside from the fact that these agencies are supposed to uphold justice and the rule of law, what has withheld them from releasing this information, which is the tape and the report, and why is it that they have not released it even up to this point?
Well, there's a lot of reasons behind this. There are 9 exemptions to the Freedom of Information Act on which this George Soros Open Society initiative is filed, and you can start off with number one, national security, and then you can get into internal agency practices, which is probably a euphemism in this case for intelligence sources and methods, none of which might be disclosed. You can get the exemption for law enforcement operations and records and things like this, and then there's the exemption for privacy. You invade someone's privacy by disclosing some of this information. And of course, you've got most of the federal judges who have spent time in the Justice Department and learned the ways and means of withholding information, which is what justice does in many cases, especially in lawsuits dealing with the Freedom of Information Act. So I think that what they've done really is simply order the agencies and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to give them an index, a Vaughn index, of what they're withholding and why. And then they go on from there. And of course, the Vaughn index is not necessarily disclosed to the general public. So we can foresee a fair amount of wrangling about what's there, what you're withholding, and why you're withholding it. Of course, in my case, when I tried to find out why I was fired by the State Department, my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was sealed as a threat to national security. So the judges can do as they please, and they can take their time on this.
Okay. Well, the last point I'd like to talk to you about, but obviously that should be left for another debate, I think. So we're going to leave that one there. Seymour Sinabas, it was very interesting, if you recall, and I'm sure you remember, when the CIA did actually conclude that the Saudi Crown Prince had been responsible for the killing. So then you would think that, they must have had some information. I'm wondering if this tape was part of that. But then that is where it kind of stops in terms of having something concrete or tangible when you have the Central Intelligence Agency coming out with that statement. Do you think that the stoppage happened in the form of the U.S. President Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump was directly involved. There was a very quick response from the CIA after the murder, and they had concluded in a high-confidence assessment that the Crown Prince personally ordered the murder of the journalists. Now, the relationship of Donald Trump and the Crown Prince is well known, and the Trump administration saw the Crown Prince as a pivotal part of their policy in the Middle East. They certainly weren't going to jeopardize his stability there, and they went all out to protect him. I mean, even before the CIA's conclusion was made public, evidence released by the Turkish officials strongly suggested that the Saudi Crown Prince had a hand in Khashoggi's brutal murder. That evidence was starting to emerge right around the time Pompeo was visiting Saudi Arabia in those initial couple of weeks of the cover-up. He met the Crown Prince at that time, and after the visit, Pompeo urged patience. He urged patience and said that administration had pledged to give the Saudi regime more time to produce an explanation regarding Khashoggi's killing. Now, compare that to the way the Americans operate, for instance, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, or those people who don't play ball with them around the world. They don't need any excuse. They'll go off and commit extrajudicial murders and killings themselves. So let's not pick on the Saudis alone in this situation. Donald Trump has form in extrajudicial killing himself. General Soleimani being the obvious example. Their partners Israel just done it again in Iran with Minister Mohsin Fakhrizadeh, I think, from the nuclear industry. So look, this is just normal practice, and for Trump to weigh in and back up his crucial partner is no surprise, and they carried that on right through their administration, right to the very last moment, because there are obviously going to be things that are going to come out which damn and indict the whole system and the corrupt mechanism by which the American state basically operates its kind of rogue foreign policies. That's not going to stop anytime soon, but absolutely clear that Khashoggi outraged the whole world, yet look what's happened. They've managed to do a public relations hatchet job in terms of covering it up. You don't hear either their partners in Europe moaning or groaning about this. Yet again, when it comes to the likes of the Islamic Republic of Iran or Hezbollah or people who are obviously fighting for their own independence in that region, the European Union, all of this gang of, if you like, what I call Anglo-Zionist, if you like, movement, are there to pick on that individual. Yet Saudi Arabia, he gets given nuclear information, nobody complains. That's what the Americans are doing. American corporate companies are now bolstering Saudi Arabia up as a potential nuclear power in that region. They get no pullback on the war in Yemen, as I said. They're allowed to operate with the likes, in producing the likes of ISIS and Al-Qaeda to unleash on West Asia. This is a carte blanche license, like the Zionist regime, that the Americans allow their partners.
Well, Michael Springman, let's look at that famous interview that Donald Trump had with the veteran journalist Bob Woodward. I don't know if you recall that that interview, but this was just recent, maybe a couple months at this point. But in that interview, Donald Trump said that he protected Prince Salman from Congress, boasting, and his quote, what I'm going to quote is what he said. He said, "I saved his." Well, I can't use the word that he used, but you can imagine what he did say. So, first of all, according to U.S. law, wouldn't that make Trump guilty if he knew that the Saudi Crown Prince had actually ordered this killing? Because according to Penal Code Section 31, titled Aiding and Abetting a Crime, if you help conceal a crime, in so many words, then you're also guilty of it, not guilty of the crime, but you're guilty under the rule of law.
Well, yes, indeed, it would be, except that this is always ignored. Look at Barack Obama when he assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki and his son in Yemen by drone strike without any kind of judicial proceedings whatsoever. The president has carte blanche to do as he pleases, even though he is chief executive, charged with seeing that the laws of the United States are carefully obeyed. So I think it's basically the Americans are want to cultivate their relationship with Saudi Arabia. When I was there 20 years ago, 30 years ago now, one of the goals of the U.S. mission was to ensure that we get plenty of oil from the Saudis. And that was done in such a way as to never offend the Saudis in any way whatsoever. The Saudis were engaged in deals with individuals to sell drugs and alcohol and then raid the parties at which the drugs and alcohol were consumed. And you couldn't report this to the Americans living in our consulate district, because that would offend the Saudis. And this is, not new policy. It's been going on for all the time the United States has been involved with Saudi Arabia since the 1930s.
Well, Sir Mohsin Abbas, right now, however, it's a new day. You have the current U.S. President Donald Trump perhaps to be on his way out. And you have a new administration, once confirmed, and if confirmed, headed by President-elect Joe Biden. You have Saudi Arabia and its oil exports to the U.S. to slump to one of its lowest points. So that kind of leaves the Saudi crown prince, at least on this issue, not to have someone who may support him at this point. We know how the president-elect feels about this, obviously very to have been very angered about what Saudi Arabia has done. Do you think the timing of this piece of news is somewhat coinciding, again, once confirmed, with the incoming U.S. administration headed by Biden?
Well, it is a fact that Biden will subtly shift some of his emphasis. He'll, I think, try to look like he's a little bit harsher with Saudi Arabia. He'll try and give his allies some sort of security that they are willing to abide by some international rule of law. But I don't think it'll be anything substantial. I think deep down, nothing will change. And the Biden administration would also engage in perhaps not such an overt cover-up, but they certainly won't pursue the Saudi establishment in any way, shape or form, in my opinion. I mean, the fact was that it was such a blatant act of covering up that Trump himself offered a stinging indictment of the Saudi effort to silence that dissident journalist, calling the series of events that led to the Khashoggi's death the worst cover-up ever. He says the cover-up was one of the worst in the history of cover-ups. That was what Trump said from the Oval Office. And he said it's very simple, and he called the whole episode a total fiasco. So not only did he do the cover-up of the cover-up, he actually was more or less boasting about this fact. I mean, I don't think Biden will be as blatant and as outrageous as this. And I think this is what the Trump regime, in terms of foreign policy, has done. It's really, in many ways, helped the ordinary public to really see the U.S. Administration and foreign policy for what it is. But not for one moment can you imagine that Hillary Clinton or the likes of Biden or Obama were very much different. Again, Obama launched more wars in his period and has a greater track record of killing people in West Asia and the Middle East, and was equally supportive of relations with Saudi Arabia as Donald Trump. Donald Trump simply did it absolutely, overtly and in your face. And that, I don't think, is now going to change a great deal. They are desperate, the Americans, to keep whatever cash is left within the oil revenues of Saudi Arabia. They want that all to ultimately come into American coffers, whether it comes through just bonds that the Saudis invest in, whether it comes through oil revenue that goes that way, or whether it comes through any other means. Real estate, for instance, the Saudis have $3 trillion of investments in American real estate. So you can see the relationship is primarily about money, but it's also geopolitical, strategically important at the moment, because the clash with the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, necessitates that Saudi Arabia is used as a base by the Israelis, by the Americans, in their ongoing, war of, if you like, terror on uh-huh. Islamic Republic in that region.
Well, let's look at the consequences of this very special relationship, if we can, and how it may affect different arenas, Michael Springman. I mean, first of all, the Saudi Crown Prince, he hasn't been humbled by this. We're looking at the most eye-opening incident in which a lawsuit was filed in the U.S. court by Saad al-Jabri, who has claimed that there was an assassination attempt that took place in Canada, where he has fled 3 years ago. He says Mohammed bin Salman wanted him dead because he knew too much. So you have that repercussion, and then you have how Saudi Arabia is still emboldened by the Saudi war, as our guest there in London said, and even looking at other things that Saudi Arabia has done in terms of silencing dissent within the kingdom, and the list could go on in terms of other violations that Saudi Arabia commits. So doesn't the U.S. see that this is going to lead to consequential incidents for Saudi Arabia to be involved in without even looking back?
Oh, it does, but it certainly doesn't care. The U.S. government knows perfectly well the Saudis have been after dissidents around the world. I was once on Al Mayadeen talking with a Saudi prince exiled in Germany. The Saudis had kidnapped people from Europe and brought them back to Saudi Arabia, and they disappeared them. The Americans know it. The Americans don't care. The press doesn't do much about it. They focus on Khashoggi, but they do very little about the other people, about Wujing al-Haflul and other dissidents that have been kidnapped from the Emirates and other countries and brought to so-called Saudi justice in the kingdom, and then jailed. So it's not going to have much of a change until and unless some people put the feet of the American government to the fire. And, of course, the national news media won't do it because they're too dependent on government sources and too dependent on organizations like these huge defense contractors for advertising revenue. So they're going to huff and puff and expect it to blow over as it eventually will.
Okay. My final question to you, Said Mohsen Abbas. You know, when we take a look at the gruesome assassination and the way that it took place in terms of the dismemberment and perhaps using acid, et cetera, you have this cover-up that's happened. Okay, we know that. The bigger question here maybe should be asked about this relationship and whether there's a possibility that agencies like the CIA, like the National Intelligence Agencies in the U.S. actually help cover up the 9/11 attacks in terms of covering Saudi Arabia and its involvement. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. The bottom line is one would have to be absolutely naive to the most ridiculous proportions not to imagine that the covert deep state intelligence of MI6, CIA, Mossad was incapable of tracking what Saudis were up to. Being such a key ally, being such a key source of revenue and such an important partner, who really imagines that the CIA, etc., wouldn't have their paws all over Saudi intelligence and their operatives? The fact is they know everything that moves within Salman's own bedroom, I would imagine. And following Jamal Khashoggi's killing, on the point of what people have reported, other victims have reported the Saudi regimes attempted to lure them into their embassies even after Khashoggi was killed. It's that ridiculous. The Tiger Squad, the death squad that's named as the squad that actually assassinated even Khashoggi, again is implicated in this. You know, exiled Saudi activist Omar Abdulaziz vouches for this. An opposition Saudi scholar, Abdullah Al-Oud, son of Salman Al-Oud, who's actually in prison amongst 30,000 to 40,000 other political prisoners of conscience held by Saudi Arabia without any real due process or law. All of these people have been, of course, now putting in these claims that this Saudi intelligence goes around killing everybody. So yes, I would say the CIA, Mossad, etc., are hand in glove with these efforts.
Thank you very much for that, Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. And thank you, Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat to Saudi Arabia. spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikabe Tahoe, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading U.S. Sanctions on China's CNOOC may backfire has been authored by Mark J. Valencia, who is a political commentator and consultant focused on Asia. Most recently, he was a visiting senior scholar at China's National Institute for South China Sea Studies and continues to be an adjunct senior scholar with the Institute. Valencia has published some 15 books and more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles. Stay with us, please. The U.S. government has officially sanctioned China's third-largest oil company and largest offshore petroleum producer, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, CNOOC. It is not clear why CNOOC was targeted, but the apparent reason for sanctioning CNOOC under this order is its involvement in exploration and drilling in disputed areas of the South China Sea. If this is the reason, the U.S. is using a rather loose and expansive definition of companies that are affiliated with China's military. CNOOC said that it was shocked and regretful that the action was based on false and inaccurate information, and that it is now comprehensively assessing the impact of the situation on the group. CNOOC Group focuses on the exploration, exploitation and development of oil and gas offshore China, along with its subsidiary, COOEC, or China Offshore Oil Engineering Company. The company is owned by the Chinese government. One subsidiary, CNOOC Limited, is listed on the Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto stock exchanges. Another, China Oil Field Services, is listed on the Hong Kong and New York stock exchanges. CNOOC's foreign operations account for about one-third of its total production. This includes projects in the Gulf of Mexico and Guyana, where it has a joint venture with ExxonMobil. But the executive order may not initially be too serious to a blow to CNOOC because it is so far limited to divestment, meaning that joint venture investments are apparently not prohibited and American holdings are relatively small, and there is uncertainty as to whether it will be continued by the incoming Joe Biden administration. Also, CNOOC may take certain measures to mitigate the risk, but there may be blowback. CNOOC owns some U.S. oil and gas fields and partners with companies such as ExxonMobil Corp on some overseas projects. It also uses American technology and equipment. So the sanctions or the fear of their expansion will have some U.S. domestic effect. But there is much bigger potential problem of retaliation by China. ExxonMobil has also undertaken drilling in areas claimed by both Vietnam and China. What if China retaliates by sanctioning ExxonMobil for undertaking exploration and drilling in areas it claims, such as in Vietnam Blocks 118 and 119? China has threatened retaliation against ExxonMobil before for doing what the U.S. now alleges CNOOC is doing. In 2008, Beijing warned it against proceeding there, suggesting that its business in China could be at risk. Again in 2011, soon after ExxonMobil announced a discovery in Vietnam's Block 118, China warned foreign energy companies against exploring in disputed areas. In May 2014, CNOOC Limited moved a CNOOC group-owned drilling rig, Hiang Xiu 981, into the area and drilled just east of Vietnam's Block 119. Vietnam claimed the rig was operating in its exclusive economic zone, while China maintained that it was operating in its waters. Until a ruling or a boundary is forthcoming, this area is disputed. That means ExxonMobil's drilling in these contracts would be legally questionable. But the U.S. seems to be implicitly taking Vietnam's side in its various relevant disputes with China, including this one. It should be noted that ExxonMobil is America's third largest company and is heavily invested in China. Its holdings range from gas marketing to petrochemicals. Indeed, it is now building a $10 billion petrochemical complex in China. If China does retaliate against ExxonMobil, it may prohibit any business dealings with it, similar to its ban on business transactions of any kind with American arms suppliers to Taiwan. Worse, it could stimulate a rethink in China regarding its economic interdependence with the U.S. This move by Donald Trump's administration during his lame duck period will make it more difficult for Joe Biden to revive relations with Beijing. But Biden could reverse this particular executive order before too much damage is done. Indeed, whether he does so or not may be a good litmus test of his administration's approach to China. Will it be an improvement or more of the same?
Good morning! voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.